turn to 17-1481, World's Inc. v. Bunge. I think we're ready when you are, sir.
Thank you, Chief Judge Prost. May it please the court. On January 8th of this year, this court held en banc in the Wi-Fi 1 v. Broadcom case that time bars for filing IPRs under 35 U.S.C. 315B are indeed appealable. In this case, in this proceeding below, at the board proceedings, patent owner Worlds made its own 315B argument. Namely, patent owner Worlds argued that non-party Activision had at minimum an opportunity to provide input and to control these proceedings below. And the evidence...
But the problem is you had the set of this consolidated IPRs going up and moving forward at the same time. And whereas you've appealed the real party and interest issue here, you failed to appeal it in those cases. And so why is the other side not correct that you've got a problem on issue preclusion, even if we were to agree with you that on the real party and interest question, at least more should have been done?
Your Honor, as to that point on the estoppel question, we've addressed this in page 30 of our reply, and we feel that what petitioner failed to address, what Bunge failed to address, was the Utah Construction and Mining case, which lays out a series of additional agency requirements that are relevant and crucial, indeed, to ask in deciding whether estoppel should apply on agency decisions. There are a number of points there. First of all, the Wi-Fi 1 case makes clear that the 315 bar is about establishing agency authority to act. It's a jurisdictional question.
Am I wrong in vaguely recalling that issue preclusion applies to issues decided in the course of deciding jurisdiction? I don't think I'm wrong about that.
Your Honor, I don't have the knowledge right now to take issue with what you've said, but I would say that one of the primary prongs in the Utah construction mining test is indeed whether the agency had jurisdiction to act in the first place. And so what we're addressing here is the fact that...
But it was adjudicated. The only piece of what you call agency jurisdiction, and I guess the agency sometimes calls jurisdiction the timing rule, is this issue. You litigated it before the board, and then in those three proceedings, it came to an end because there was no appeal. And there's actually a difference. You may not care about those patents anymore, but I'm trying to figure out why there shouldn't be issue preclusion about an issue that on its merits is pretty serious.
You're right, Your Honor. It's actually very serious. And indeed, as Judge O'Malley mentioned in the Wi-Fi 1 concurrence, it's actually one of the fundamental protections of rights to patent owners in this process. And if we look at the Utah construction mining test, one of the things is the ability to fully and fairly litigate. Now, what we would look to...
And I understand that there are fundamental fairness inquiries that need to be undertaken. But is the placement of the burden of proof, even if we thought it was wrong here, does that fall within that category of opportunity to fully and fairly litigate. You litigated and they may have reached a wrong decision, but it was still litigated.
Your Honor, actually that gets to a very important point, and I hope I answer your question here. One of the important points is that the agency came out against us on a question of law, in essence, first of all, which is the contract interpretation. And that, as we've set forth in our briefs, is a question of law, and the Federal Circuit does not need to defer to how the Patent Office decided the contract interpretation.
Is there an exception on collateral estoppel for questions of law versus application of law of facts or facts? Is that what the point you're making?
No, Your Honor. Simply that the court here is not bound to interpret the agreement the way the agency did. And in terms of the burden of proof, Your Honor, I think what you're getting at perhaps is 316E, which is that the petitioner has the burden of proof going forward. Now, in terms of proving whether the Utah construction factors are met here, I think the mere fact that there is an error of law by the board and how they interpreted the contract and an error in law and how they applied the burden confirms that, in fact, those factors are not met. The Utah construction factors are not met.
I'm really not clear on what you're saying. So I've got just one quote for Utah construction. I don't have the case with me, but exactly what in Utah, what are you pointing to? That because this was the board's decision was based ultimately here on a legal determination construing a contract, that that somehow is an exception?
No, Your Honor, not an exception, but it is evidence that the factors of the Utah construction tests have not been met. So I have page 30 of our gray brief open, and we get into the factors. We lay out the factors at the bottom, beginning page 30 of our reply brief. And I'll just note that Bungie did not cite to this case at all. There really is no analysis by Bungie on this point. But we have first factor. The agency must have jurisdiction to resolve the issue. Well, in fact, this is the fundamental question. If the agency doesn't have jurisdiction based on 315B, then they don't have jurisdiction to resolve whether Activision was indeed a real party in interest or not. The second factor, the agency must act in a judicial capacity.
I'm sorry. Yes, of course they can decide whether they're a real party. I mean, you're asking for a remand, so we're going to tell them to decide it in your favor.
Your Honor, actually, that does raise another question, which is, as Judge Toronto wrote in the Owens Corning v. Fassfeldt case, where there is only one outcome, and that's what we believe here, based on Section 7A15J of the agreement at issue here, there is only one outcome. There's only one outcome. There's only one interpretation of that provision that gives effect to that entire provision, and that is that Activision had, in effect, a legal opportunity to control the IPRs, or at least to review the things that Bungie was doing in preparation for this. And so, given that, and given the fact that Bungie has not asked for a remand, we believe that this court can decide this question without a remand. It can decide that, in fact, this contract does support Activision having, at minimum, an opportunity to control, as stated under the Taylor v. Sturgill case from the Supreme Court, that the board applies.
I'm still not understanding why you think the fact that the agency must have jurisdiction to resolve the issue is not met here. It depends, I guess, on what we think the issue is. But if the issue is whether or not there was a real party in interest here, that question, you're saying that the board didn't have jurisdiction to decide that issue, and that's why there's no collateral estoppel?
Your Honor,
I understand what you're saying.
Yes.
If I understand the point, if the point is that if there's a real party in interest problem, then the board doesn't have jurisdiction to resolve the merits of the IPR.
Correct, Your Honor.
Patentability. Mm-hmm. But so, just can you tell me what you're saying about the jurisdictional point?
Your Honor, my point is, once again, it resides in the fact that if the agency has to have jurisdiction, and if the facts point to one conclusion, which is that the agency didn't have jurisdiction, then it answers the first factor. But, Your Honor, what I would point out is that we don't need to decide that the Utah construction test is not met based on that first factor alone. We have other factors. We have that the board must follow procedures sufficiently similar to those used in trials. And what we don't have here is an opportunity to get discovery. Our discovery motion was denied, despite the fact that...
Well, it does follow procedures on discovery. It just denied your request for discovery. That doesn't mean that they... I mean, doesn't this suggest must follow procedures sufficiently similar to those during trials? Again, you're quibbling or arguing, maybe even correctly, that you should have been allowed discovery. But are you suggesting that because in the prior proceedings they dismissed it or they rejected your argument and they wouldn't allow discovery, that subsection 2 applies here?
I do. I absolutely agree with that, Your Honor. And the fact that there was a motion made for discovery, there was a request for documents, those documents were solely in the hands of Bungie. There was no opportunity, aside from what amounts to a stroke of luck, finding, and some diligence, of course, finding the agreement online between Activision and Bungie regarding the Destiny products. This is indeed, once again, getting into this important fundamental protection to a patent owner on the 315B.
The point of collateral estoppel is that you had the ability to appeal those rulings, as you have in connection with these IPRs, but in the absence of an appeal, it's final. Right. I mean, whether it's a discovery dispute you had that you think the board got wrong, but does the fact that the board had a discovery request that it rejected and you failed to appeal their rejection of that discovery request take it out of the collateral estoppel bucket?
Your Honor, again, I believe based on these factors, it does. What we've dealt with here is a situation where the board did not follow procedures sufficiently similar to those used in trials. They didn't give an opportunity for discovery. You're correct. We did make a motion for it, and they denied it.
And could have appealed that.
You're correct, Your Honor. We could have.
Can I step back? At page 30 of your brief, where you...
38, Your Honor?
30 of your reply.
30,
brief,
yes.
Where you have, not in quotes, under the Utah construction test, one, the agency must have jurisdiction to resolve the issue, and three more things.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not finding any language in Utah construction about jurisdiction. Can you help me?
Your Honor, it's interesting you asked that question. We did quite a bit of looking in that as well. Utah construction has been interpreted usually, what I would point
does
to is...
Does Tennessee Elliott say that? I don't have that one in front of me.
It does, Your Honor. That's where I think the... I apologize, this is my recollection during the preparation here. The Tennessee v. Elliott case is where they interpret Utah construction to require these steps. They cite to it, although the factors really come out sort of in the progeny of Utah construction in mind.
And B&B doesn't say anything, does it, specifically singling out jurisdiction? Does it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Your Honor, I would simply
can I ask you another question?
Sure.
Let's put aside any distinction between jurisdiction and other things. Let's put aside distinctions between law and fact. Let's assume for a minute that whatever the adjudicatory process in the IPR was in the three proceedings that you ended up not pursuing were full and fair. You could have gotten correction of anything that was harmful. Is there nevertheless some objection to some reason not for us or the board, but I guess at this point us, to apply issue preclusion?
Is there a reason not to, Your Honor?
Right. I mean, so suppose all these elements are met. Is there anything about the essential simultaneity of these proceedings that should take the matter outside the scope of issue preclusion? There's a peculiar and, I think, on net, probably unhappy consequence of saying to you, in order to preserve your real party and interest argument in the three cases you care about, you had to take an appeal in all six. That's not a happy systemic consequence. Is there a way of, does issue preclusion law allow consideration of that as a reason not to give issue preclusion?
Your Honor, I don't have an answer for you right now other than to say with an agency situation, I would still point to the Utah construction test. I think from a matter of judicial economy, you certainly, I would expect, would not want people to appeal things unnecessarily. What we've done is we've appealed the cases, as you said, that have outcomes that need to be addressed. While there are other decisions out there, they were argued simultaneously, the issues are the same in effect.
Would you agree that, for instance, just to take an example, if different IPR, some of the same prior art was at issue, and in that IPR, the board assessed what that prior art meant, what was covered by that prior art, And then you had, because maybe it's a different combination of prior art, but you still had one of those same pieces. In this appeal, you would not be able to challenge that prior art determination if it had become final. Do you agree with that, that on the merits-based issues, that you would be collaterally estopped?
Your Honor, I believe that is an accurate statement, although where I would differentiate that from our situation here is we're talking about agency authority to act. And so we don't have a situation in that other, in the hypothetical that you've created that I understand, where the agency has acted when they shouldn't have been able to, or they've interpreted an agreement in a way inconsistent with law in order to continue hearing the case, when in fact the proper interpretation of the agreement would have shut them down and said, you have no more ability to make these statements.
Is there a distinction between making a determination for purposes of instituting IPR 1 and making a determination for purposes of instituting IPR 6? In other words, you're saying that even if I give up on my battle over whether they should have been allowed to institute IPR 1, that doesn't preclude me from battling over whether they could institute IPR number 6.
Your Honor, I still come back to the Utah construction test, which simply says, as far as the factors that have to be applied here, these factors have simply not been met. And either what we didn't do was pursue an appeal that increased the court's workload unnecessarily.
What about, are there any, arguably, I mean, we don't know. I mean, the board didn't do an analysis of the collateral estoppel issues, so we've not evaluated the earlier consolidated grouping of IPR cases. For all I know, but you what hasn't been brought up here, there might be distinctions between the type of argument that could have been made regarding the real party of interest. I mean, there could be differences between what was in play in those IPRs and what was in play here.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, I think what you're getting at is, in fact, we have evidence of actual opportunity control, or excuse me, we have evidence of opportunity control through this agreement. Had we been entitled to discovery, we certainly could have found differences of how the patents were treated. In other words, Bungie filed two IPRs against one patent and single IPRs against other patents. We don't know why, other than that's what they chose to do.
Why is control the test? I mean, you know, well, you seem to be conceding that point, and that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, the statute uses much broader language than that. Legislative history contemplated a much broader concept than that in terms of privies and proxies.
It's correct, Your Honor. What we focused on is going, for example, we haven't come in and tried to argue a change in the policy that the board is implementing, which is the Taylor v. Sturgis factors. One of those is control or opportunity to control. Because we were denied discovery, we've never been able to go out and get the evidence of the actual control or the actual communications between Bungie and Activision that led to an indemnification demand that led to...
I guess what I'm asking is, why are you conceding that Taylor is a governing principle in connection with this particular statute?
Oh, and that I shouldn't be. I hope I'm not being interpreted as conceding that point, Your Honor. One of the practice guide statements from the USPTO is a party who desires review. Now, you're right. A petitioner, the statute 315B says petitioner, real party in interest, or privy. And so we've been focusing on the real party in interest because of the Taylor v. Sturgill case. But you're correct that the practice guide of the USPTO says the party who desires review. Activision was in active litigation with Worlds for 2.5 years before the Destiny product was put at issue and Bungie stepped in and 6 months later filed an IPR. Bungie wasn't around for 2.5 years and suddenly the Destiny product gets noted up and they're there in the case. Now, did Activision desire review? Absolutely. But in terms of following what the board is saying and how the board is applying the law, we were simply working within their construct, and we haven't come to you to ask for a change in the law on that point.
Okay. We far exceeded your time, so we'll restore some rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The other side.
May it please the court. I'm going to first start out with a point on the RPI that goes, Judge O'Malley, to your last question about control and the Taylor factors and the emphasis there. But there's a critical factual point here to be clarified. I think it it comes through in both briefs, but worth reiterating, and that is the litigation between Activision and Worlds that is being referenced had nothing to do with Bungie. It's never had anything to do with Bungie. Bungie's never been a party to that. No Bungie product has ever been added to that litigation. It's a completely unrelated...
But there was chatter about the possibility.
There was a letter saying from Worlds Council to Activision's Council indicating they might want to add some products. Bungie product was listed as something they may want to add.
And you haven't disputed that. When you think about control, case one and case two, there are two possibilities, right? Party in case one can control the party in case two. The other is that the party in case two could have controlled the party in case one. So in this instance, you haven't disputed that the question is a legally relevant one, whether Activision, which is the party in case one, could control Bungie in case two, namely the IPR. Even though it's usually the other way around in thinking about preclusion.
Well, that is their argument, that Activision had an opportunity to control by virtue of this agreement. But you know, there's a fundamental point here is the estoppel vehicle is the litigation case that had nothing to do with Bungie. The control vehicle is an agreement in an unrelated endeavor. So it's,
what I don't understand is control is not the test under the statute. So why are we focusing so much on control or even Taylor, which is a totally, you know, didn't even address the statute, had to do with Article III standing, when the statute talks more broadly in terms of privity, when the legislative history cited California positions, didn't even mention Taylor. Why are we talking about
it? It's a great question, and that's what I wanted to address, Your Honor. I agree with that 100% and would point to the legislative history that's in the practice guide that talks about emphasis on the practical situation. It talks about defining whether a relationship is sufficiently close so as to justify the application of the doctrine of estoppel.
Right. So, but California Positions talks about the kind of thing like where you're litigating as a proxy for someone else. So given this contract that says that you're tied together with respect to this product, even with respect to the intellectual property rights, and the threat of adding this, your product, to the other litigation, why isn't there at least enough from the existence of the contract to shift the burden to you to prove that you're not acting as their proxy?
Okay, so I'll start out with the practical situation, right? And there's absolutely nothing to do with that litigation. It's a completely different contract. And the California physician's test or case you reference, the sufficiently close relationship, all that. But I also want to point out that the practice guide in the context of that discussion also makes clear that a party's relationship in an unrelated endeavor is not sufficient under this consideration.
We're not bound by the practice guide, though, right?
Well, the board is bound by the practice guide, but...
But we are not. We're doing a statutory interpretation here as to what RPI means.
We're analyzing whether the board abused its discretion or whether its findings are supported by substantial evidence. And I would say that a factor in that review is going to be whether the board's following their own rules and procedures.
Well, the board did... All they did, they didn't have other witnesses, right? There was no evidence before them other than the contract itself, right? So where were the factual findings when they were just construing the language of the contract? Your side came back to the extent that they should have, as I agree with Judge O'Malley, the burden should have shifted back to you all, whose burden it is, burden of persuasion, always rests with you in any event, but what you came back with was exclusively attorney argument. There was no evidence, right?
Well, no, that's not correct. So two points there. One, the board looked at both their relationship. They did what they should have done under what you're pointing to is a requirement that this is not a singular focus on control. It's looking at the relationship. So the board did what they're supposed to do. They looked at the litigation, noted that that Bungie was never involved in that case, no product was ever involved in that case, and then looked at the agreement in an unrelated endeavor and went through and looked at the content of the agreement and made an interpretation of that. As far as the evidence question, Your Honor.
So the interpretation of the agreement would have been a legal conclusion.
I think it's an evaluation of facts. So there
isn't the question, I mean, once you have, you talk about a presumption, which doesn't even make sense to me because there's nothing in the rules that even anywhere references a presumption. There's no logic that would support the notion of an evidentiary presumption. So isn't the notion that they supplied the contract and therefore made a non-frivolous argument about the relationship between the parties, wasn't that enough to say that it was your burden to come back with actual information beyond the contract itself that would refute the notion that you were acting either collectively or even in protection of each other's interests?
Yeah, well, so 2 points in response. The contract is a neutral piece of evidence. It's not like this is world's evidence that they came forward with and it has to be counterbalanced with some other piece of evidence. Both parties were and the board were looking at a single document and trying to interpret what that means.
So but then they relied on your attorney argument in saying what
it meant. Well, they rejected World's attorney argument and found our attorney argument more persuasive. But I wouldn't characterize that as my friend has in the briefing as being an instance where there's evidence on one side, nothing on the other. That's just not true. There's a document where the attorneys on both sides are arguing how that should be reasonably construed, and the board listened to the arguments and found Bungie's arguments more persuasive.
If you were to take general principles of contract construction, those include things like the overall relationship between the parties, including how the parties treated the agreement, after it was entered into, anything that relates to the general circumstances, the practice in the industry, all of that. The board did not allow evidence of any of that and didn't consider it. So they're doing a contract interpretation without even having the tools necessary to engage in a contract interpretation.
Well, I understand the point. I would say for this particular instance that just wasn't necessary for the issues that were being advanced on one side and being disputed on the other. And that is looking at the nature of the contract that you had Bungie creating a product and somebody selling it or distributing it for them. So it was a development publication agreement. And then the identified portions of the contract that were being pointed to with the assertion that this demonstrated actual control by Activision were just not credible arguments. And the arguments being advanced on those were rejected.
Step back for a second. When you filed your petition, and I should know how this works, but did you have to file some sort of certification that you have identified all real parties in interest?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's some evidence that you have done that. Mm-hmm. Then next stage, there's a contract. Contract, let's assume, for purposes of this question, that on its face, the relevant provision that we've all been talking about sure sounds like it could well cover the three ways to clear intellectual property rights. Show that your product's not covered by the intellectual property, get permission from the owner, or kill the intellectual property. This is the third, right? This is one way of doing that. On its face, it sure sounds like some evidence to meet any reasonable burden of production. At that point, it is your burden of persuasion under APA 556D, because you're the one asking for relief, to show that you've actually met there's no missing real party in interest. And yet the board, in its discussion, seems at that point to be placing, even at that point, to be placing the burden of persuasion on the other side. Isn't that wrong?
That is wrong. So sticking with the...
No, I mean, isn't that improper?
Had they done that, that would be improper, but I don't think that's what they did. So if we...
So like on page 506, this is in one of the institution decisions, patent owner has not shown that Activision has an opportunity to control this inter-parties review. On the premise that the contract is at least susceptible to the reading that it covers efforts to terminate the relevant IP, how is it proper for the board to be talking about what the patent owner has not shown at that stage where the issue is joined by evidence on some side as opposed to absolutely nothing?
Based on the arguments that were being advanced by Worlds, that there are two provisions that in their view demonstrated control, and so the board taking that argument into consideration with the identified evidence and taking into account Bungie's argument about why those interpretations were wrong at face value, there's nothing wrong with the board saying, we've looked at this, we've listened to your arguments, and we don't find World's argument credible.
Wait. At the bottom of page 509 of the appendix, the board says, accordingly, patent owner has not demonstrated that the agreement gives Activision any opportunity to control this proceeding. One, that puts the burden on the patent owner. Two, it limits the whole consideration to the question of control. And then they say, in addition, we note that petitioners expressly denied any control or funding of this proceeding by Activision. Petitioner represents to the board that petitioner is solely responsible for the cost and control of the inter-parties review. And then they say that on this record, we accept petitioner's express representations. I mean, how is that not completely putting the burden on the patent owner and allowing attorney argument to substitute for evidence?
Whose attorney argument? Because both parties were advancing nothing but attorney argument here.
I mean, well, the other side's attorney argument said this should at least open the door to further inquiry. And basically, your attorney argument just simply said, don't bother. We're going to promise you that they don't control us.
Well, I wouldn't characterize it that way. I would characterize it as there's a requirement that a petitioner make a representation, and the board takes the position like they do and like the patent office does in many other instances. When a party makes a representation, absent evidence to the contrary, they're going to accept that representation. So
fair enough. Mm-hmm. Absent any evidence to the contrary or any non-frivolous assertion that representation is not accurate. Mm-hmm. It's fine for the board to say, if nobody objects, we're not going to go behind this ourselves. We're not going to put a burden on ourselves as the board. Mm-hmm. But once there's a non-frivolous objection to the statement of RPI, then the burden has to be on the petitioner to establish that they are the sole and only real party in interest.
And in this context, so 2 points again. One, the evidence that was advanced was rejected as raising a sufficient level of concern that this was an issue. And two, you know, this idea of I think putting this in context, the idea of a party proving, you know, that another party doesn't control something is a difficult.
That's the party that's got all the information and the evidence.
But if there is no information and evidence, what do they come forward with? It begs the question.
Okay, your time's almost up, but good news is that we controlled the time. So we're going to turn to the issue. If you have some comments on, you know, we spent most of the time with your friend talking about this issue of estoppel, and certainly he relies heavily on Utah construction. So I'd like you to tell us whether you agree with his interpretation of that case or his application, and if not, why not?
Yeah, I would. Thank you, Your Honor. I would respectfully submit that my friend has misapprehended the jurisdictional issue in the Utah case. The idea of, and I think you touched on this, Your Honor, the idea is whether an agency has jurisdiction to even address a situation, not whether once we get past their ability to review an IPR petition, whether they messed up a jurisdictional issue or not.
So right? You think resolving the issue means, in this instance, resolving the threshold issue, which is real party and interest?
Yeah. Is it appropriate for the board to be addressing real party interests in the context of an IPR petition? The answer to that is yes. That satisfies this jurisdictional aspect that's being referred to, and it's not to be confused with a substantive point of challenge that the board can and does address, which Worlds disagrees with. That's an issue for appeal.
Something happened in the interim here. I mean, this court decided Wi-Fi, mm-hmm. which at least arguably changed the landscape in terms of whether or not that question is one that's subject to review at all. I mean, it could have been that at some point in the past under Acades, no one would have appealed the issue, sought review of the issue, because the position seemed to be that it was not reviewable at all. Does that have any play in the context of this case?
I don't think so.
Can you remind me when we decided Wi-Fi?
January.
It was after they filed.
I'm sorry, January what?
January 8th, 2018.
Okay, their time for appeal on the three IPRs had not yet run. That would have run at the end of January or beginning of February, I think. Is that right?
I'm not sure. It was January of this year, right?
January of this year.
Yeah,
this
so their notice of appeals had long since passed.
Off by a whole year.
But that doesn't save them, Your Honor. There are
actually, why doesn't that?
Because there are six cases.
That is, if the only ground that they could not actually have appealed that issue back when the appeal time was still available.
But they did with these three cases, right? They knew they could appeal it. So there's six cases sitting there together the same circumstances.
But at that time, all they knew was that they could appeal, let's call them the merits issues, not the timeliness issue in these IPRs. And then turns out they could get all the issues.
Well, that would,
and they didn't care, evidently, enough about the merits issues of the three other IPRs. But they couldn't independently have appealed the 315B issue.
That would be a great story, but it doesn't check out under these circumstances. All six cases had the same timing. They picked three and left three,
right, because
all at the same time.
I'm sorry. So your answer is just that they were, in this appeal, they obviously were not deterred from raising the real party and interest case,
even though
they were similarly situated. In other words, both appeals were being done before the Wi-Fi appeal.
Very clearly not, Your Honor. I agree with that. And even one of the three cases that is being appealed here, Your Honor, has no merits challenge. They've only appealed the RPI issue. So the Wi-Fi decision was in no way a barrier to them. And I think the bar was recognizing that this was a... the 315 bar appealability issue was a live issue.
I asked your friend on the other side a kind of practical judicial efficiency mm-hmm. of the system question, which is troubling. Namely, you have a bunch of IPRs involving different patents. There's an overlap here. They don't care enough about some of them. And yet, in order to preserve one common issue in the ones that they do care enough about, you're going to insist, by way of collateral estoppel, that they burden us with six IPR appeals instead of three. That doesn't seem very, I think the word I used before, like a happy consequence for the system.
Are
we stuck with it?
It is a happy consequence in the sense that the other side.
Maybe happy for you.
Well, it doesn't really take. I mean, as far as the efficiency concern, it doesn't really take much other than another line in a notice of appeal and a consolidation. There's no additional briefing, and we see that in this case. They've got one unified set of briefing for three cases. The only additional. Component that would be required is a listing of three other case names. So there's, I mean, it's minimal burden to add three other cases on the exact same issue. And then in terms of the other side of the issue preclusion and unhappy consequences, takes into consideration everybody else that has to, you know, suffer from issue preclusion or should be able to rely on issue preclusion.
So but if it's essentially cheap on their part to go forward and file six cases instead of three cases with no additional briefing, it shouldn't make any significant difference to you on the other side either.
So not for the briefing. I'm talking about the idea of issue preclusion is that the public relies on things that are decided, right? I mean,
but here it was a peripheral issue. I mean, to the extent we're going to consider the policies here, it seems like if they didn't care about those other patents, then we're saying, well, you had to appeal it, even though you don't care that you lost the patents, but just to preserve in the future, for posterity, a real party and interest question, which you don't care about here. You don't care about the patents and the fact that you've lost them. Do you understand?
I understand.
Why that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense?
Well, I understand how it can appear as a tactical failure, if you will, and a technicality. I understand that, but you know, on the other side, it doesn't take much more than listing a couple more cases in the notice of appeal and in a line on the brief.
Might there not be? I mean, we haven't considered any of the other IPRs aren't even before us, so we're not even clear what's at stake there or what arguments might be relevant to the real party of interest that may or may not be relevant to this case. Would it not make sense to take a look at a more fulsome record in order to be able to decide rightfully the collateral estoppel question?
Well, I mean, that raises, you know, an issue if to the policy point of whether this is a good idea or a bad idea to embrace or reject this type of practice. And I could certainly envision situations where parties are selecting out cases and perhaps it's resulting in the court not having a fulsome record by virtue of its selection.
Let me slightly refocus that. First of all, would the board be subject to the same issue preclusion doctrine that you're asking us to consider?
I think that's an excellent point, Your Honor, and the answer is, I believe, is yes.
Okay. So just focusing on this case for a moment, if I look at the contract provision that is the key. That is the focus of the talk about real party and interest. Mm-hmm. It is about clearing legal rights to a product. Is it not possible that if you looked at the claims of the, was it 988 or 998, that's the common patent?
Yes,
988. Mm-hmm. And the other two patents, so everything that's in the three IPRs that ended without appeal, that one could say, one might be able to say, we don't know, this goes to the Chief's point, that they didn't really have control, Activision, didn't really have an opportunity to control IPRs on those because there was no product that, I guess, Bungie was concerned about to which those claims had a bearing on. And therefore, Activision's opportunity to control wouldn't apply to those, but it might well apply to these, so that in issue preclusion terms, the issue would not actually be the same.
Well, it's possible, but this goes to the fulsome record analysis, right? I mean,
right, which we don't have, and so the question is whether on the collateral estoppel question, we should send that back for the board to, as you say, apply the same collateral estoppel principles that you're asking us to apply, but to do it with eyes open knowledge about the possible differences between those three IPRs and these three IPRs, and maybe the answer will be they're not actually different, but do we really know that?
I think that's a good question. I mean, I think it illustrates some of the problems that result by not simply tagging cases. You posed a hypothetical whether there could be some argument in other cases that presents a more fulsome record on point. So following with your hypothetical, if there's some unselected patent where it's very clear that it's not a product review situation under that provision of the contract, that would seem to undermine the entire argument that this was, you know, some sort of that this whole package falls within the product review situation, right? I mean, that would undercut that whole argument, that interpretation of the contract. And it would underscore the fact that if there's anything in the contract that's on point, it's more toward the indemnification provision, which specifically states that this is all Bungie's
problem. Why
didn't
you submit a declaration spelling out the interaction with Activision as it relates to the IPR or any discussions that you had with Activision relating to the IPR? If this was such a pristine thing on your part and Activision had nothing to do with it, why was there no declaration?
Oh, we felt it was clear from its face. I mean, you've got an unrelated litigation with a distributor and they're trying to tag Bungie with estoppel based on an unrelated endeavor. We read through the trial practice guide and this seems pretty on point that looking at the practical situation and the fact that there's an example given that in a relationship in an unrelated endeavor does not link two parties up, that application to the contract in our view seemed to be persuasive. It was deemed persuasive. And we didn't think additional evidence was required. I do want to make a clarification here, if I may, and that is there was no challenge here to the board's decision to deny discovery. This the issue that was raised on appeal was whether the board erred in deciding the RPI issue, not that the board abused its discretion in denying.
But they're
discovery.
Not only asking for reversal, they're asking in the alternative for a remand, which suggests that there would be more fact-finding or analysis forthcoming.
Well, that's an issue for remand. My point is an issue for this court is whether, not whether the board abused its discretion. And some of the questions we've been discussing get to that point. Should the board have given more discovery? Should we have looked into this more? That's not the issue on appeal.
There's a difference between allowing them discovery and probing your position beyond attorney argument to require you to submit proofs or additional proofs. There's a difference between that.
Whether the evidence is sufficient, and I understand the point, and I would just emphasize again that there is a piece of evidence and there's attorney argument that is limited on both sides.
We have to bring this to an end.
I appreciate it, Your Honor. Thank you.
We'll restore 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Perhaps a fairly important clarification to my friend's answer to Judge Toronto regarding whether there has to be a certification in the petition. And Judge, just so you understand, there is a signature by counsel saying who the real parties in interest are. However, it's not signed by a client or a person having knowledge. For example, it's not like an ITC complaint where you have to have a certification or a discovery response.
But when people file, I'm not sure the answer to this, but even in our cases where you file a certificate of interest, it's signed by the attorney, but the presumption is that he's gone to his client and checked all of this out. Right?
I would hope so, Your Honor. But we simply don't know.
And from the record, what about the final point your friend made, which was your failure to appeal the denial of discovery? I mean, unless we're an all-in-out reversal mode based on the legal question of what the contract says, are you still saying, even if you don't go there, it's included in our appeal that this should go back for a reevaluation?
I think the court does not need to remand, Your Honor. I think that you can decide based on the contract that you have and the terms of that there, which say that there is, in fact, an opportunity for Activision to review and approve, or on the flip side of that, deny.
But what if we're not prepared to go that far? Have you preserved your right on appeal to have us do something less than that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think a remand is certainly an alternative solution here that we are asking for. One, I don't know the Patent Office will necessarily open up the record again. They have a policy that they've issued recently about remands and how they're going to handle remands. But we think even if you go send it back to the Patent Office and they decide not to open up the record again, which is, as you noted, Bungie pushed back repeatedly through the discovery motion. They decided not to submit a declaration establishing the real parties in interest with their reply, which they could have. They took the chance that, in fact, in the final written decision, the board would stay put on its path that it had been on, and that it wouldn't go back and reconsider in its final written decision who, in fact, the real parties in interest were. So, in fact, with that evidence, the board very likely could come back and reach the same conclusion that this court could reach without a remand. In other words, based on this agreement, there is, in fact, an opportunity to control. Activision is a real party in interest.
As collateral stop is an equitable doctrine, is it not?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
All right. Have you found any cases that say that in certain circumstances the court has the discretion not to apply collateral estoppel?
Your Honor, thank you for bringing that up. And this is a point that we did address further down in our the brief reply brief dealing with page 30 and so on and so forth. And page 31, we do have a sentence here that this court, in particular, the Federal Circuit in 1994, held that redetermination of issues is warranted if there is reason to doubt the quality, extensiveness, or particularly in this situation here that we see, fairness of procedures followed in prior litigation. What we also see as we get into the NLRB case on page 32 and also the Mosher Steele, now we recognize that there are some different views here, but collateral estoppel is normally not applied to conclusions of law made by administrative agencies. And the Patent Office's legal interpretation of that agreement is, in effect, an error of law. And the Patent Office's decision to put the burden of proof on the patent owner in effectively disproving that Activision was a real party in interest, rather than the burden of proof on the petitioner to prove that Activision, in fact, was not, also constitutes an error of law. And those errors that this court can correct without any deference to what the Patent Office said. Those, in fact...
Yeah, but that's a pretty broad brush that's kind of scary to think about if we were to embrace something like that. I mean, a lot of what the board does, obviousness cases, those at bottom, even though there are underlying questions of fact, are questions of law. So that's a kind of difficult thing to grasp.
If it may offer, Your Honor, this would actually be a great case for this court to take a firm stance on this point, because it's saying, don't rely on the agreement. Don't rely on a question of law. Bungie, if you want to prove that Activision isn't a real party in interest, put a declaration in. Let that person be cross-examined. And if the record shows that, in fact, Activision had no involvement whatsoever, then you have the facts, and then the deference applies. And so that is an opportunity, in fact, for this court to make a statement, tell petitioners how to deal with this so that they don't have this problem again. And Your Honor, one last point here. In terms of whether the Destiny litigation is, in fact, separate from what's going on here, you can't find that from the agreement. You simply cannot look at this agreement and say that based on the terms they wrote back in 2010, Activision has no right to be involved.
The word product in the provision that's defined at the beginning of the agreement to cover the Destiny products?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And in fact, 15.1, 15.3 of the indemnification provisions are very consistent with 7A, 15J, which say that Activision has an oversight, like a helicopter parent. They can watch what Bungie is doing, and if at any point Bungie is doing the wrong thing or taking, you know, the prior art search hasn't been good enough, the claim charts aren't good enough, your analysis on this point isn't good enough, they have the right to tell Bungie, do it again, get it right. Your Honor, I see my time is up.
Thank you. We thank both sides, and the case is submitted.